Okay, we're in James 3, and where we ended was the first half talking about the tongue and its ability to do damage. And also, you know, it ends with some really very penetrating questions for all of us. And you know, where it talks about, you know, a water well doesn't, you know, give out, you know, fresh water and bitter water, and a fig tree doesn't produce olives, and a vine doesn't produce figs, and salt water doesn't produce fresh water, and, you know, the whole thing is, you know, but it, you know, all these things don't do these contradictions, but man can, you know, bless God, you know, praise God, and then also curse man, and it, you know, can do it almost simultaneously. And he's saying it shouldn't be that way. Well, moves into the next part about wisdom, and he says, you know, it begins with this question, and I don't know, there are a lot of, you know, when you talk about wisdom, you know, one of the things we might think about wisdom is as it's used in, you know, here. Sometimes we only think of wisdom in terms of, you know, what's kind of practical, though wisdom always is practical, however you define it. But, you know, sometimes there's people that have very, very strong views, and you know, they see themselves as zealous for truth, for right. But sometimes in that zealousness, they get, you know, carried away, and they don't see anything else. They only see, you know, it all becomes very focused on one area. And James would come back in, and I think in this section, you know, would be saying, you know, is that wise? And, it, you know, some of that challenges our assumptions at times when you start thinking about wisdom. You know, who's wise, and is that wise? And, you know, sometimes, you know, dogmatism gets equated with truth, and, you know, which is clearly not the case. But it begins with a question. Who among you is wise? Who's wise? Who has understanding? It begins the verse 13. Who among you is wise in understanding? Wise here is, you know, in that sense of something that comes, and as James would say elsewhere, you know, something that comes from above. This is wisdom from God here. So we're not talking about the wisdom that's simply, you know, a person that, you know, can apply truth. And, you know, as you look around nature or something, you understand how things work. But it's something more in the sense of that it's, you know, it's divine in its nature. It comes from God. For James, it also clearly includes morally uprightness. You know, he talks in this verse and then later about in the sense of walking in purity, walking in uprightness. So it doesn't lead to strife. It doesn't cause disorder. It's you know, it leads more to, you know, it would lead toward peace. And so it's the opposite of what is sought and what is taught by its opponents. And it's not speculative, but manifests itself in practical moral results. One commentator says, in the Jewish usage, wise describes the individual who possessed moral insight and skill in deciding practical issues of conduct, a wisdom derived from his personal knowledge of God. You know, here, wisdom and understanding virtually are synonymous. the wisdom would have a more the emphasis being on the moral quality of it. So wisdom has that sense of moral uprightness would be included in wisdom. Understanding is in that sense of being an expert, learned understanding. This is the only passage it's used in the New Testament. One writer on New Testament word says it's an expert, a skilled and scientific person with a tone of superiority. If there's going to be, while these words are pretty synonymous, wisdom would have more of an emphasis on the moral character and understanding more on the intellectual aspects. So that, if we're going to make a distinction, it would be in that area. From that, he gives a directive, an exhortation that says, let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. So who among you is wise and understanding? So everybody raises their hand, of course. And then James says, then show this by your good behavior, by your deeds in gentleness of wisdom. So this is a directive. It's an imperative. Let him show that is... you should make this known. You should point this out. This should be something that becomes almost in the sense of obvious, in the sense of to prove or to explain. So the proof must be given. And in this case, it's not the proof given by, I can be clever or I'll argue you, but by the good life. I don't know that this is... this is an application for this passage, but I was just listening to coming up here on the sports radio. This basketball player for the Washington Wizards that took a gun to the locker room because felt it wasn't safe for his kids to keep it home anymore. four guns and. So he evidently, and I didn't hear this, but he, released a statement yesterday that, clearly that his lawyer had written, and it said that he had come to realize, how serious the issue with guns is, and, it's not something to be joking about. And then he went to the game last night and was
shooting at his teammates.
And, and so here comes that, the proof must not be given through clever argument, but by, good life, or at least by demonstrating. So this afternoon he was, he indefinite suspension, but also in the statement from the commissioner was that it might involve even more than that. And as the commentator was saying, said, what's more than an indefinite suspension except to be, expelled, totally. So it's, but that's that sense, so this idea of let him show isn't just state it, but actually do it. And this is by his good behavior. So this is by the way of life, by one's conduct. So this is that sense of, actions matter, actions speak. Kind of the old thing, actions speak louder than words. Well, in some cases they do, and that's the case here. 1 Peter 1:15 says, but like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves in all your behavior. And so this is where it's looking at. So it's not looking at the right proclamation, but rather the right living. In that regard. But not only that, it says in gentleness of wisdom. But gentleness of wisdom, which is, an interesting combination of words there. So gentleness is that sense of humility, consideredness, meekness in the older, favorable sense. Meekness has a very negative term, context anymore. But, you know, as in the older usage of meekness was a positive, you know, that sense of being considerate, being courteous, being humble. The, you know, a Greek word study dictionary says that this word means the mild and gentle friendliness, that the Greeks value this virtue highly so long as there is a compensating strength. Thus, rulers should be gentle with their own people and stern with others. Law should be severe, but judges should show leniency. Gentleness is a mark of culture and wisdom if it does not generate into self-abasement. So, you know, gentleness, you know, almost as Aristotle said, it's the mean between, you know, two extremes. So he said, you know, like a bad temper and spineless incompetence, between extreme anger and indifference. So, you know, that idea of meekness or gentleness is far different than the way we use it, the way it was used. Some have used an illustration, and that would just be an illustration, but it would be like a powerful horse that is bridled, under control. And so it's the power, but it's under control. So gentleness is, you know, Aristotle saw it as this median point between extremes, so that you're not, as somebody, you know, talking about anger, that you're not angry all the time, or that you're never angry, but you're angry at the right time. And so this isn't talking about anger, but it's talking about that sense of the gentleness of wisdom. Wisdom, once again, is that natural wisdom that, you know, it can be used, that natural wisdom belongs to the world, or, you know, I think as here, it's that wisdom that God imparts. And so he's looking here. And so that's the directive. Let them show. The one that has wisdom, so as we go around and say, oh, I'm wise, and then James is saying, well, then show it by good behavior and by the gentleness of your wisdom. And that's quite different from, you know, I'll prove to you an argument that I'm wise. Then it moves on, speaking about a wisdom from below. He moves into this section about a wisdom from below. Verse 14, he says, but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. So bitter jealousy, says, if you have, you know, it brings this contrast in it. So here's what wisdom should be, and you're saying I'm wise, but if you have bitter jealousy, selfish ambition in your heart, you know, there's a contrast here. The bitter, you know, literally it was talked, as he's already used it, and be that sense of bitter water. But figuratively it's talking about to be embittered, to be harsh. Jealousy is, you know, can be used in a good sense biblically. You know, in the sense of zeal, or, you know, like God is jealous for certain things, you know, that sense of zeal. The bad sense is how we usually use it, and it's in that sense of envy. And so here, I think the NIV has envy. So it's in that sense of harsh zeal, or almost that negative competitiveness. And selfish ambition, it'd be that self-seeking pursuit of things. You know, it's not. You know, it's not that one shouldn't seek. You know, pursue things. You know, to pursue an office or to pursue something. But you know, where selfish ambition comes in is that seeking that political office. For personal gain, and doing so by unfair means would be kind of the way Aristotle talked about this term. And so it's, you know, that sense of strife. So here we're looking at selfishness, selfish ambition. You know, it's a willingness to use unworthy and divisive means to promote one's own views or interest. And know, so that's what it's looking at. You know, if I can get ahead by this, then that's, you know, what I do. So he's saying that's not what's in mind here. He says, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. That is, you know, don't boast or exalt, triumph over in that regard. So don't be arrogant and go contrary to this, to truth. And he talks about the source of wisdom there. So there's three descriptions of wisdom that he talks about here, and they're kind of given in an ascending order. He talks about earthly, natural, and demonic. And so earthly is just contrasted with heavenly. It has a kind of a horizontal aspect to it. Natural pertains to, you know, the natural life. We're not talking about supernatural. It's not of the spirit. And then demonic obviously comes from another source. He's saying here, he says, this wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, is natural, is demonic. And so he's saying these, not just one, but it kind of fits this whole category. And it kind of keeps growing in its heightened sense of negativity. You know, it's earthly, but then worse than earthly, it's just natural. And then worse than that, it's demonic. And then he gives an explanation as he moves forward with the word for. He says, for where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder in every evil thing. So where these things occur, there's disorder. And then as he looks at that disorder, he says, in every evil thing. Now, this is in the context, remember, I mean, it's kind of moved so quickly that we lose sight, if we're not careful. This is in the context of wisdom. And he's asking, who among you is wise and understanding? Well, it sure looks like that his audience that he's talking to, that there are some there that are claiming they're wise and they have understanding. You know, follow me, listen to me, I'm the one that's in charge, et cetera, et cetera. And now he brings these challenges. But when the wisdom that we're purporting to have actually is involved with jealousy and selfish ambition, actually what ends up being is disorder. You know, so it's, you know, that becomes a hard thing as, you know, within a church, because there ought to be a sense of seeking to serve, seeking offices. I mean, even in Paul's writing, you know, he talks about the one that aspires to be an elder. So there's something positive about seeking to serve, seeking to be in a position, seeking to use one's gifts. But the question becomes, is it self-serving? Is that why? And then that, and that seems to be the context that James is using it. And he's saying, yeah, there's some of you that are claiming to be wise. You're saying you know, you got all this understanding, but it's all about promoting yourself, not really doing the other. It says, so there it ends up being negative. In contrast to that wisdom from below, there's a wisdom from above. Verse 17, but the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So he talks about pure. That is, in the sense that one follows God's directives. It's, you know, it's a virtue that's viewed as being the source or the key to other, you know, the following qualities here. So it's pure in that regard. Peaceable. It's only it's used here and also in Hebrews 12:11. So to be peaceful, gentle. You know, that sense of being considerate, yielding, gentle, kind. Reasonable is, the NIV has submissive. It's in that sense of being compliant, though, you know, we shouldn't read into that, that sense of, you know, once again, meaning that one doesn't ever take a stand, but it's, you know, obedient, compliant is what it basically means.
It's willing to yield.
Yeah, that would be... Yeah. And that'd be very good. One commentator says it conveys the thought of respect for the feelings of others, being willing to waive all rigor and severity in one's dealings with others. So it's not that you don't have convictions, and you know that you just agree with anybody and you know go along, but you're submissive to the truth, and you listen carefully to others instead of just attacking. And then talks about full of mercy. So it's that sense of compassion toward those in distress. So it's not, you know, giving out what one has deserved, but, you know, providing what's needed. Then talks about full of good fruits. Unwavering, you know, would be... you know, it's that sense of, you know, that there's a certainty. There's not a pushing toward discord. Without hypocrisy, that's the sense of being genuine, sincere. And so wisdom is quite different. The wisdom from above is viewed as quite different from the wisdom from below. So when we say we have wisdom... Now, you know, I mean, to say, well, if one is wise, there would never be any conflict, you know, would be an overstatement, because then it becomes the question, you know, what or who's, you know, actually the, you know, the real source of the conflict. But if one is, you know, if a person is the one that's causing the discord, if... you know, if they're jealous, if they're self-seeking, if it's all about them, then it's not really a wisdom. And sometimes, you know, some of the teaching I've been exposed to more early on in my Christian life, really, after a period of time, maybe you learned a little more and you can definitely look back, you can see it was very self self-filling for that person. It was, you know, it was all about making the teacher look a certain way or be a certain way or thought of a certain way. You know, there was an arrogance in that. And it's not dogmatism. You know, you can be extremely dogmatic and have all these qualities of that he's talking about wisdom here. But you can also be dogmatic and it's all about self. So, it's not a matter if somebody's dogmatic. It's not if they're strong, speak strongly. And it's not necessarily about us making the judgment about what we see in others in this passage. Because he's saying, you know, this is directed to us. You know, we should show ourselves by good, our, you know, wisdom by behavior. And, you know, and if we're being motivated by self-seeking things, then that's not wisdom. But wisdom should flow from, you know, should be in line with what is pure, what's peaceful or peaceable, what's gentle, what's reasonable, what's full of mercy, what's good fruits, what's unwavering, what's without hypocrisy. And then he moves on, and there at the end he says, "And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace." And so it's a kind of an interesting, you know, as James goes through here with all of his stuff, the way it just in such a short book abruptly changes topics. You know, he talked about faith and works, and all of a sudden he's talking about the sins of the tongue, and then it's, you know, into wisdom. But yet, having said it abruptly changes topics, there most likely is some common threads there. And, you know, as he talked about, you know, about teachers early on, that there's some of this aspect that goes through here. You know, in chapter 3 and verse 1, let not many of you become teachers. Well, you know, not only in the sense of bridling the tongue, but also in the sense of, you know, some most likely were... placing themselves in positions to be authority, And yet, their authority wasn't coming from a wisdom from above, but from a wisdom from below. Well, you got thoughts, insights? Yeah, no, I think in the sense of, definitely, because, that's what he's making this connection between wisdom and holiness, if you want to, and purity. He's not putting these in separate categories, and I don't know that, I don't know if they were at this time, if that's part of it. But we do today as a society, not necessarily talking about, not speaking about the Christian community, but as our society in general, quote, wisdom, intelligence, understanding has nothing to do with morality at all, as society sees it. And so as you... And I don't know exactly where they were at this point. We have to kind of look at this and read back and from other understanding try to infer. But I can see where this would become, something along those lines would become very, would be something the church is facing now and will face even more so in the future as, young adults are saturated with that concept. That morality doesn't have anything to do with whatever it is you're talking about, and so you move in, and so the idea, some of this starts, to filter away. So, whether or not that's exactly what James is talking about, I'm not sure, but definitely in that sense, as what you're saying, he's saying that this proclaiming to be wise, then. Wisdom isn't just to be seen in, as we think about, that I can give these, great connections between life and, truth, kind of Solomon's deal, but you got to go live it. And,
proclaiming themselves to be wise, that's your first sign.
Possibly. Of course, James doesn't necessarily say that, but he does say if you're, and he doesn't even say if you're claiming. He's saying if you are wise. So, yes, you could look across an audience. A lot of people might say, "Yeah, I'm wise," but then the question becomes, okay, what's the litmus test for being wise? It's not can you solve the riddle, but how are you living? And And if you look at James in regard, in kind of, we're connected with Jesus and like the Sermon on the Mount and stuff like that, you there's some of that kind of thing, very much there. And it's not about theological truth, saying that, theological truth doesn't matter. Well, it clearly matters. But there is that sense of, okay, now live out the theological truth. And that's the Sermon on the Mount is very much... that, and so I think James would follow in that line. So I think that is very much what he's saying. And so you have these areas. Like I said, I was exposed to teaching when I first became a Christian was very much in terms of truth. No. And there weren't any things about living anything. It was just if you gain enough information. And so I think, you know, James is in that regard. Yeah. Yeah, it's becoming more of a challenge because of a society that, you know, embraces relative truth. And, you know, I mean, if you, you know, kind of this, you know, the aspect of relative truth in a society, you know, from what I've read, you know, it kind of ties in with the end of World War II, you know, with the, you know, ending of the war, and, you know, the baby boom generation, that's kind of when it started. We really started seeing the society that shift. So, you know, so people my age are the ones that first grew up with that. So, which means you're in the transition period. So I grew up with a very clear aspect of absolute truth, but there's that transitioning going on. I remember when I was in college that, you know, I became a believer at the very end of my college, and I could graduate one summer, but I needed one more hour to graduate, and it didn't matter what the hour was in, I needed 1 hour, and but I couldn't take a class because I was taking two classes, and there wasn't any way I could go attend the class, and so, the you know, one of the classes that, you know, I'd had some friends take and stuff was something, marriage and something or other. I don't remember what it was. And, you know, through the Bible department. And so I remember I went to the Methodist Student Union and talked to the guy there, you know, because I needed to be able to take this class kind of by correspondence without going. And so I took this class, and I, you know, I made a C, and I, you know, fortunate that I made a C, because I remember on the final, one of the questions was, okay, your sister is, you know, living with this guy, or going, you know, her, your sister and this guy wanting to get married, that's what it is, they're wanting to get married, but his father will not pay for his, continue paying for his education if he's married. And so what should they do? Well, the right answer for an A is they should live together. Well, that's what was being taught, you know, on campus in a liberal, student, you know, Bible union type thing there. And that, so that was, you know, 30 years ago. And so while, you know, my exposure growing up was more, you know, right and wrong, a lot of people were starting to be exposed to that. Well, now kids, you know, the only place they're really going to hear right and wrong is if their parents are saying it or if they're in church. No. And so, you know, Erica was, Erica and Dan they're on a cruise this week. And Erica was talking to a friend that she knew in high school. And you know, she knew her wedding, and they got talking about their wedding was going to be this past week, and they were talking about the time and realized kind of where it was at, that she'd actually be able to go because they were going to Galveston to catch the, you know, the cruise ship. And so they figured out they could go to the wedding. And then they were, you know, talking about what, you know, what they were doing on their honeymoon and so forth. And, you know, and they were going on this cruise out of Galveston. And Eric was like, well, there can't be that many cruises going out of Galveston on Monday morning. And they got talking more, realized they're going to be on the same cruise ship. And so this girl was saying, you know, Eric was saying, well, you know, we don't want to, you know, I mean, we'll be there, but we don't want to be in your way, you know, way. And we, you know, we're not going to, you know, we'll kind of avoid you type thing. And you know, and the response was, oh, well, it's not that kind of big deal. You know, we've been living together for a long time. We're, you know, just getting married. So, you know, I mean, it's, you know, and I, you know, I don't know where they're getting married, but it's, you know, very likely they were getting married in a church, and they, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's just that aspect. It's not viewed as wrong, you know, and nobody's seeing that this is wrong. And you notice anymore, I mean, there's a positive sense, because, I mean, I kind of argued this at Bethesda, in the sense of when I was in South Dakota, there was a sense of, you know, if a girl was pregnant, what used to be called out of wedlock, you never hear that phrase anymore, you know, there wouldn't be a baby shower for her. And I can understand part of that. I mean, I can understand you don't want to encourage. But then on the other hand, you're sitting there going, well, isn't a church a place that people ought to turn to if they're repentant? And shouldn't they be embraced if they're repentant? And so it looks to me like the issue should be, is this person repentant? And this girl had, you know, had an affair, you know, and I think she was, you know, I don't have any reason to, you know, to doubt her. She didn't know the guy was married. I mean, that doesn't make it right, but she didn't know the guy was married. And she got pregnant, and she wanted to make a public confession. You know, we weren't asking her to this church. And that's what you had to be careful of when she came, just making clear that, you know, we're not requiring this of her. But so here's everything points, she's repentant. And, you know, so why shouldn't you embrace her and do whatever you can to help her? And so, yet you can go, you know, having done, you know, kind of argue from that standpoint, you go to another place now where it's just common anymore, you know, in athletics, I'm talking about college athletes, that, you know, these people have children, and it's just, you know, got a 3-year-old son, he's this, he's that, and it's just, you know, it's almost viewed positively. It's not negative at all, and you're just kind of like, you know, how do you go from this to that? And that's kind of how you get there. And so I think those kinds of things do come into play. And I think that'll be a challenge in the church in that regard too. But I think the other one that maybe is maybe more where we're at, or where we, you know, the church has been, would be in the sense of being divisive, argumentative, being you got your one thing you're pushing, and you just create division if you're not with it. I've been around you know, people that they were pro-life, and if you didn't have the same zeal for pro-life as they had, meaning if you didn't go, you know, to the marches, if you didn't go picket, if you didn't do those things, then they questioned your spirituality. And you can take that with any movement. It doesn't matter. It could be creationism. It can be anything. And we have that tendency to whatever I have a passion about to interpret that because I have that passion, anybody that loves God would have the same passion. As opposed to recognizing that maybe that passion comes with giftedness. God's laid it on your heart, and so you go do it, but maybe God's working through somebody else in a different area. And I think, you know, some of that comes into play, I would think. Let's look at the test here.
But I think the people that are that really do have an earthly demonic wisdom, feel very good and getting things to go the wrong way.
Yes.
They're the danger.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other ones you notice right away, these people are not.
Mm-hmm.
But the kind that, I mean, if you look at politicians, some of them, you know that they're up to no good, and they're so good at pulling it off. And
I think that's true. I mean, you do notice, I mean, like, you know, when there's if you take a church, when there's conflict, and let's say that, the conflict that's in the church is, there are various reasons for it, and it's not a clear cut that, there's nothing wrong. There, things aren't smooth, things could be a little better, as life is. Nobody's perfect. But you get that person that is, they have nothing going for them typically in life. they're not a leader generally, but all of a sudden they pull people together for that cause like that. And you're kind of like, how does this happen?
Yeah.
And
in my experience, my dad was a preacher. And so I heard stories from him too, and it's amazing how many Christians in the church would put politicians to shame with their ability to
manipulate and get things done. Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. There was a guy in South Dakota that he, I knew prior to me going there that the leadership did not view him as one that had the qualities to be a leader. He wasn't going to be on one of the boards. They just saw that something had happened to this guy. He wasn't the way he used to be, and that people knew that something wrong. But when he got really upset about things, everybody listened to him. And he got all of this attention. And that just always baffled me. You say, on the one hand, he's not qualified to lead. So he can't lead from a positive standpoint. We're going to let him be a part of the board. Positively, we're not going to let him lead. But we'll let him lead negatively. And, so you can... There is that aspect that can happen. And yeah, but see, that's some of the places we ought to stop in some of those situations, and we ought to be looking at this passage and saying, "No, wait a minute, does this fit?" And so this person, okay, I'm not saying we don't have problems or some of this doesn't need to be looked at, but wait a minute, why is this person being allowed to, stop everything that's going on and make us deal with his issues when it doesn't fit in it? So I think there are ways to use it, but like you said, it's really hard. The only way that kind of stuff works well is if you're the third party out there. If you're not really involved and you're out there and you could see it and speak up, then it might get some attention. But if you're being attacked, like you said, you definitely can't be the one that goes, "Look here." Usually, because usually people tend to, get on sides, and more than taking sides, we ideally we ought to be looking at this kind of stuff, which is ideally. I just love that. I love right now, and I wished I was smarter, and I love to be analytical. I'm just not analytical enough. That I wished I was, and to have the information, the Texas Tech thing fascinates me to death, because people are on two sides so clearly. It is, and it's not just talking about tech. I mean, just talk to people in your church. It's amazing. And you listen to this on the news, you know, you hear some people, and it's so interesting that the one channel is a Fox channel, and they typically dislike ESPN. I've never heard anybody on ESPN dislike Fox, but those people at Fox, they do not like ESPN. And so they just jump on it from the standpoint that, you know, that's an ESPN analyst, and so it's all wrong. And I, you know, I heard this the other day, this guy talking, and he was on Fox, obviously, and he was talking about the, you know, SMU, you know, getting the death penalty as a program, and, you know, when did that happen? Well, it happened when Eric Dickerson and Craig James were recruited, along with some other people, and that's, you know, they were the ones recruited, and it came out after they left, and of course, the coach, you know, he goes to, you know, coaching the NFL at that time. And so all the people that got punished were gone. But anyway, this guy is saying, so who is he? You know, he's been, you know, pampered all of his life, and he, you know, so he was in the wrong, and he was getting all these feedback, and, you know, and it was like, where does that come from? I mean, I'm not saying it's wrong, but what a leap. But it's just, you know, they get in these areas. So, yeah, we're very seldom are we truly objective. And that's what's scary sometimes. And you have to, you know, try that. And so if you use these standards, you know, if we'd come back to these and try to evaluate, then we'd be a lot closer to being truly objective. And, you know, looking at the falling down, okay, what's really the issue? And so so often people get off the issues and they start talking about, well, you know, Tech's really not committed to winning, or, you know, this or that, as opposed to, you know, or what's Craig James's background, as opposed to what's the, you know, is there an issue and what is the issue? So it's kind of interesting. Well, any prayer requests?